as my main gear set down, followed too quickly by my front wheel. We slammed down hard, and loose shit flew everywhere inside the cockpit. I kept her straight as I slowly applied what was left of the hydraulic brakes to slow our speed. Hydraulics don't work well with the engine offline. I could have cared less about the gear we left behind. All I had with me was my rifle, as I left the plane in the middle of the field and sprinted to the fence with John in tow behind. We got to the fence, and John entered the code. The mechanical clinking sound indicated that the cipher was unlocked. We entered the fence, shut it behind us, and finally, we were safer. I walked through the hatch last night into Tara's open arms and concerned eyes as she gazed at my bloody clothing. I spent most of this morning resting and getting medically tended to by Jan. She seemed to think that stitches were a good idea and abruptly reopened my wound. She cleaned it up and proceeded to painfully stitch the laceration. I didn't argue. I simply took a few shots of Captain Baker's Captain Morgan to ease the pain. April 21st, 21:18 hours. We spent the day hiding the aircraft with brush and grass and moving the supplies from the plane to H-23. John is vigorously examining satellite photos to try and determine the identity of our ground-to-air attackers. Tara has stuck close to me since we got back. Tomorrow, we will attempt to access the weapons locker with the hacksaw. April 24th, 20:41 hours. All is silent in the hotel. The infection around my rib area is receding. It is itching and feeling hot, vice the familiar soreness of deep infection. Jan tells me that in a week she will probably be cutting them out for me. Too bad for me. She used regular sewing thread. On the morning of the 22nd, William, John, and I took turns sawing the huge lock off of the steel weapons locker. I sawed for 10 minutes. The other two did the same. We applied lubricant to the saw to keep it from burning up and breaking the tips of the saw blade. It took almost an hour to cut the lock. In my mind, I half expected a gaggle of corpses to come falling out of the locker when we opened the door. Of course, this was not the case. We were in luck. Inside this large locker was a cache of military-grade small arms. There were 5 M16s, and one of them was equipped with an M203 grenade launcher. Not being a trained infantry soldier, I had some research to do long before I ever tried to deploy the grenade launcher function. Also inside our little pot of gold were 2 military-modified Remington 870 shotguns and 4 M9 Berettas. As we started to take the weapons off of their racks and into the control room, I noticed another rifle, semi-hidden in the rear of the locker, behind the ammo cans. Reaching back into the locker to see what it was, I noticed that my hand was about to pull a Russian weapon out of the U.S. missile silo weapons locker. If it were not for the inscription on the weapon, I would have forever wondered what it was doing there in the first place. In English, and some Russian, the following was written. For Colonel James Butler, USAF. Cold War, 1945 through 1989. Dmitry Nikolaevich. It didn't take much for me to have a decent guess at why this weapon was here. Although my Russian is rusty, and never was any good anyway, I still recognized Polkovnik as Colonel. I knew also that Vena meant war, and the Cold War was considered officially over in 1989. This meant that Kolodny was probably Russian for cold. This Russian AK-47 was more than likely a gift of goodwill from one fallen superpower military man to Colonel Butler. Of course, I had no idea who Butler was, but it was probably a safe bet that he commanded this post sometime during the Cold War and had encountered his Russian adversary prior to the fall of the USSR. This made me wonder what Mr. Butler had sent Comrade Nikolaevich in return. I guess I will never know the answer. This weapon looked in excellent shape. I decided to take it to my compartment as a sort of souvenir, a souvenir much more useful than a shot glass. We are now well armed with at least one military-grade weapon available per person. Unfortunately, the females have no idea how to operate any of these weapons, and this was something that needed to be fixed soon. John and I went out again to better hide the aircraft. Now you would have to be pretty much on top of it to find it. John is still busy figuring out all of the various systems of this complex. There is still the intermittent mechanical sound coming from somewhere in the facility, and John and I are trying to isolate the source. After examining literally dozens of photos, we were unable to find any sign of our attackers from the other night. I half wondered if he, she, they would be good enough to locate us just by the general direction the aircraft was headed. I knew we would have been shot down that night if I had left the strobes and takeoff lights on. A well-lighted target would have been easy to hit. The gunman was just aiming at the sound of the engine. We are all taking turns monitoring the cameras at regular intervals, and John seems to think there may be a motion-sensing function that the cameras are able to utilize with the right commands. For the time being, we have some weapons to clean. April 26th, 1954 hours. Took some time, but finally cleaned all the weapons that needed it. I wouldn't mind getting some ammunition for the AK-47, as it requires a different caliber than its domestic comrade, the M-16. I spent the day yesterday teaching Tara and Jan how to load, aim, and adjust for wind with the rifles. I feel that those skills are in high demand these days. In a fit of boredom, John and I took some satellite photographs of Houston. We were unable to locate any survivors. At one point, we thought we had a decent lead, as on the roof of one of the taller buildings, we saw a hastily made banner that read simply, "Help." It wasn't until John increased the magnification that we discovered that help had already arrived in the form of the undead. There were four of them on the roof, milling about, probably the same ones that constructed the makeshift banner. We have also been studying the diesel generator manuals for this complex. There are large batteries that we had not noticed before in the back of the generator room, out of plain sight. Upon closer inspection, the battery gauges were in the red, not the green. John and I researched the meaning of the gauge being in the red and found that it meant the batteries had lost charge from neglect. We practiced the startup sequence and then performed the real thing. It wasn't until the noise was so loud that John and I had to shout at each other before we realized the implications of our actions. We rushed to the control room, and John immediately switched the camera at the main access doors. They were still there, and they didn't seem to react to the noise. John and I were a small distance from the generator room here in the control room. It wasn't loud, but you could definitely hear the steady hum of an engine. Satisfied that we did not unleash hell upon ourselves, we headed back to the generator room to monitor the battery gauges. They were steadily moving toward green. It was only 2 hours before they were at full charge, and we shut down the generators. Main power is still holding, miraculously. In the back of my mind, I keep feeling the ripple effect of what that muzzle flash meant. Why would someone shoot at another human survivor, unless said survivor was trying to hurt them? I don't see what joy another human being would get out of killing a living person in a world like this. Since January, I had definitely done my share of killing, however. I haven't had the choice of leveling my weapon on a living human. In light of recent events, this may certainly change. Amigos. April 29th, 23:05 hours. It has been a very uneventful few days. I have been checking the security cameras at regular intervals for any sign of irregular undead movement. I feel that the ones at the front access door are not totally useless. They will tell me if anything living gets near them. I consider them sort of my backup front door alarm. Considering the threat of possible living human aggressors, we spent some time over the past couple of days checking our physical security. We made sure to lock the hatch to the silo so that no one can climb down like we did and get in. Still, no joy on closing the silo doors. John seems to think that some sort of failsafe was in place to ensure that no one aborted a launch by simply shutting the doors. Bits and pieces of the old world keep flooding my mind. I am not sure the fate of the friends I once knew. Their names are all but forgotten. I do miss them. One friend owned his own company and was a successful businessman. He had a wife and kids. We were close. Part of my mind wants Craig to still be alive, surviving with his family. However, the other part of me just wishes his death were swift, as I feel those that died quickly were the lucky ones. My friend Mike was leaving for New York to attend a culinary art school there. Ironically, the bullet that killed him was released from Hotel 23. This facility was the backup for the rogue bombers. I suppose I would rather go in a hot flash than be torn apart by the hands of over 12 million undead. Duncan was a professional lounger that didn't believe in working full-time. I suppose he was the one that had it right. Instead of being a hamster on a wheel for his last days, he continued his mantra of just being Duncan. April 30th, 2010 hours. Heard a loud thud coming from somewhere in the complex about an hour ago. After checking the inside of the complex, we could not find the source of the sound. 23:42 hours. I'm hearing strange thumping noises from inside the complex. John and I are headed to check the security cameras now. Truth and Consequences. May 1st, 14:24 hours. The loud thump that was heard last night kept playing back in my mind. The sound appeared to come from inside the complex. However, after a good inside inspection, we found nothing. This morning, that changed. We started hearing intermittent tapping, bumping sounds, again coming from inside of the complex. We again checked the cameras just to make sure. We checked the perimeter. John sat there for a minute and suggested, "Why not check all of them just in case?" I agreed, and we began flipping through the cameras inside the complex. They all showed clear, until we reached the missile silo camera. The launch must have clouded up the lens, because it wasn't very clear at all. John tried to switch to night vision mode, but apparently this camera was not designed for that function. We continued to watch. A large, dark figure moved in front of the camera, blocking the view momentarily. Then, more sounds coming from inside the complex. Whatever or whoever was tapping, pounding on the silo walls. I decided to go topside and look down into the silo from above, avoiding the possibility of putting myself in a potentially compromising, deadly position. I grabbed my carbine and started climbing the steps of the alternate exit leading to the helicopter pad and the large silo chasm. The cool May air rushed in as I opened the sealed door. I stepped out into the sunshine, allowing my eyes to adjust. The first thing that caught my eye was the gate. It wasn't closed. I walked up to the gate and checked it for forced entry. Nothing seemed wrong, except that there was some dirt on the buttons themselves. For all I knew, any of us could have pushed the buttons with dirty hands, so I dismissed this and walked over to the gaping hole in the ground. Fearing that the gusty wind could push me into the hole, I crouched down into a prone position and eased my head over the side. Looking down into the hole, I found the source of all the strange noise from the night before and this morning. At the bottom of the silo stood a mangled Air Force officer with his arm showing numerous compound fractures sticking out from his rotted skin. The hideous creature took notice of the shadow I cast below and attempted to climb the ladder up to his meal. I almost laughed at the creature as it attempted its ascent. I suppose the fall from up here broke its arm and dislocated its shoulder. It would put its foot up on the first rung and then fall backwards from lack of coordination. This undead former officer was dressed in exactly the same uniform as the two that were here when we showed up. Coupled with this and the fact that something had to open the cipher lock, I assumed the worst. This could suggest that these creatures may retain more than primitive residual memories. This officer must have been stationed here and succumbed to his death months earlier, only to stumble here last night and somehow remember how to punch the 5-digit code to get in. Now came the task of disposal. I couldn't afford the full-on noise of my weapon being fired from up here. So, I decided to climb down into the silo halfway to shoot it. This wasn't something I was wild about, but I would rather do it this way than draw the attention of the legions at the front of the complex. I swung my legs over the edge and began my descent, weapon slung over my shoulder. At halfway down, I held on with my left hand and readied my weapon. The creature was rapid and wanted nothing more than me to fall down and break my legs. I would be helpless as it devoured me. Thinking of this creature's spite towards me, I took aim and destroyed it. I told John the news, and he definitely showed concern about the gate and how the creature was probably the thing that opened it. I wanted to check its pockets, but I was in no mood to do it now. We would leave it there until tomorrow before we took it topside for disposal. May 4th, 2109 hours. My mother would have turned 50 today. All hope is lost at the prospect of my family's survival. John and I changed the code on the exterior gate in the event we had another visitor. The day after our encounter with the hole jumper, John and I decided to check his pockets. Absolutely nothing. He did, however, have something that caught my eye. On his left arm was a nice new-looking Omega wristwatch. No use letting it go to waste. The hour hand of the watch was 1 hour behind mine, due to this thing being unable to set daylight savings time. Other than that, it was still running accurately. It was an automatic, and the movement of the corpse kept it alive. It was a nice find. I am going out to check the aircraft in the cover of darkness tonight. Played with Laura today. Took Annabelle for a walk also. I let them roam free while I repaired the weak barrier surrounding the launch doors. There was an open spot where the corpse tripped over it and fell. The wind shifted, and Annabelle could smell them. The hair on her back stood up like a hedgehog, and she started barking. I pointed at the dog and signaled for Laura to pick her up. It was pretty funny seeing little Laura trying to hold Annabelle while she wiggled. Enough of their world for one day, I suppose. Back inside we went. May 7th, 2036 hours. Although the sound of the evening rain cannot be heard from inside the complex, I know it is there, just like the moans of the dead outside. Thunder and lightning have dominated the sky for hours now. The CCT picture is crackling as the lightning bursts hit near the complex. I suppose no storm could be of harm to us under the ground. However, I bet a tornado could take down our perimeter fence. In between interference, I can make out the undead horde outside. Many of them are being blown off their feet by the wind, or being knocked down by the ebbing tidal wave of the other undead. Digging through the lounge area yesterday, I found a book titled Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood. I spent most of the night last night, and most of the day today, reading it. I suppose it sort of parallels my situation, in a weird sort of way. No need to go into it. I doubt anyone else will be reading it anyway. Sort of depressing, I suppose. John and I have been hearing chatter on the HF radios. It is definitely not garbled. However, it seems that the people, persons, speaking, are using some sort of brevity code. How optimistic of them to assume anyone gives a shit. Tara and I worked out together this morning. Push-ups, sit-ups, side-straddle hops. Won't stop till our freaking heart stops. That little line brings back memories of my Marine Corps drill instructor from Officer Candidate School. What a fucking hard-ass. I bet the son of a bitch is still alive somewhere, making someone miserable at this very moment. May 10th, 1953 hours. On the night of the 8th, something caused the undead at the front of the complex to move away for a few hours. Watching on the cameras outside the front complex, I could see their attention diverted. Their rotting heads swiveled around in that familiar expression of food for the taking. The hundreds in view of the camera faded into the night. What they were after, I do not know. William and I have a theory that it could be the same person or group of people that shot at me in the aircraft. It only makes sense that they would scout this area, considering its obvious value for sheltering. More chatter on the HF band. I was able to make out the following words: band, offensive, and perimeter. I am not certain the order they were spoken or the context in which they were used, however, they could mean many things. We have a few thousand rounds of ammunition from the weapons locker, but I don't think we could repel intruders if we were grossly outnumbered. If they breached the complex defenses, they could defeat us. The girls have been learning how to aim the carbines. However, I feel it necessary for them to get some actual live fire time with them to be at least semi-proficient. It would be lunacy to do it anywhere near the complex, as it would only draw them to our position and they would see us flee back inside the fence. I will begin preparing for a daytime outing with Jan and Tara in order to make sure they can fire the assault rifles when the time comes. I overheard Jan teaching Laura some basic mathematics. I suppose with no school around for her to attend, it is not a bad idea for Jan to keep Laura learning. Annabelle is getting fat from lack of exercise and lack of real dog food. May 14th, 22:09 hours. I took the girls on a little outing on the 11th. Hiked out about 1 mile around the complex so that we could see the main entry doors in the far distance. It was William, Jan, Tara, and myself. We took Jan and Tara out so that they could become more proficient with the M16s that we had acquired from the weapons locker. Instead of wasting ammunition, we decided to aim for the undead at the complex for target practice. We eased inward toward the main entry area until we were about 500 yards away and within a clear field of vision. I was spotting with binoculars while William kept a scan behind us. Then Jan and Tara were already loaded and carried extra magazines. It was now time for them to actually get to fire the weapons. They pulled back the charging handles, and I heard the clicks as they released, shoved the round into the chamber. They took aim. I plugged my ears with 9mm rounds and pulled up the binoculars as they fired. With nothing really to aim at, they fired at center mass in the crowd. Through the binoculars, I could see some of them fall, while others had brown dust blowing off them in places where the rounds hit. They weren't the only ones here for target practice. It was my turn. William, Jan, Tara, and I waited as the massive formation of the undead began moving toward the location of the gunshots and away from Hotel 23. The girls continued to pick off the stragglers as I loaded the M203 mounted to the M16 I was carrying. I had never fired a grenade through one of these before, but I had carefully read the manual over and over the past few days. A group of at least 300 was making their way toward our location, with a straggler here and there around the formation. There were more than this behind that group that finally got the picture something was happening, and they too started our direction. The first group was about 200 yards away when I fired the grenade. Not knowing the characteristics of the weapon, I overcompensated and fired between the group of 300 and the larger group behind them. I killed some from both groups. The girls were still firing, aiming for headshots. William was still checking our flank, trusting us to be his forward eyes. I slid the second round into the launcher. This time my aim put the grenade into the center of the nearest group. The round exploded and fragged at least 50 of them. The concussion knocked half of them on their ass. It was like watching dominoes fall on themselves. Sure enough, many of them slowly lumbered back onto their feet. Now that I knew the capabilities of this weapon, and the girls had some real-world experience with the M16, it was time to head back. We disappeared into the tree line and circled back, hidden by the foliage. We returned to the complex. Trouble in Paradise. May 16th, 12:02 hours. We are now under siege. This morning at around 05:30 hours, we heard a loud noise from above and within minutes started hearing those familiar thumping sounds, very similar to the sound heard when the lone undead air officer fell into the open silo. I lost count of the thumps. Must have been 20, maybe 30. John, Will, and I went to the control room and reversed the surveillance recording to a spot on the hard drive just before the loud noise. On the screen, we saw the source of the original noise. A tow truck, similar to the trucks that tow tractor trailers, was chained to the cipher lock gate chain link fence. I could tell the driver had put the hammer down due to the mud and grass they were throwing up behind the tires. The gate and a 10-foot section of fence instantly uprooted out of the ground, leaving a 15-foot open space in the fence. The tow truck was all but surrounded by undead as it sped off into the night. We could see them pouring into the perimeter, tripping over the destroyed fence section. We switched back to normal monitoring mode, but it didn't do much good. I caught the last few seconds of seeing 5 men put potato sacks, or something like it, over the cameras. Why didn't they destroy the cameras? The only camera left is the main front access camera. I assume they either didn't see it, or the dense population of undead was too great in that section to deal with it. We hear intermittent sounds from topside, but really have no way of knowing what is being planned. I theorize that if we were to open the silo access doors, we would have a small army of beaten and battered undead to contend with. I can hear the sounds of their muffled pounding even now. They want out of their cylindrical prison. That isn't entirely true. They really only want one thing. Another thing that is on my mind was, why didn't they just drive the huge tow truck right through the fence? It would have been safer than getting out and attaching a chain to both the fence and the truck, unless they were trying to minimize damage to the compound. John is working the main camera. He can see vehicles moving behind the mass of undead. Just when they get into plain view, they turn off the beaten path toward the back of the complex where we are. John counted 6 vehicles in all, excluding the tow truck. The sun was just coming up. Right now, it is quiet. It is going to be a long day. 2018 hours. I don't know why we didn't think of this before. They placed the bags over the cameras to disable, not destroy them. John switched the camera view from normal to thermal. We were able to see any and all living human movement through the cloth bags as if they weren't even there. We have been panning the cameras back and forth, getting head counts on their numbers. Their orange and red glow can be seen swarming around numerous vehicles in their group. Multiple gunshots are apparent. As they fire, I can see the hot flash of their muzzles through the thermal cam. Their weapons don't look military. They look more like hunting rifles. They keep moving, drawing the dead away from this area, then back again. I suppose they can't stay in one place due to the overwhelming number of undead in this area. They seem to be systematically herding them away, then back. Pretty ingenious. I suppose they have been surviving on the run since the beginning. I bet they had been casing us for days, and they may have even been outside when we were testing our weapons. I don't hear any cutting tools or anything that would lead me to believe they were trying to force entry. The main camera in the front of the complex is still fully functional and shows an empty parking area on night vision mode. These marauders have successfully cleared out our front door for us, but I have no idea if they are just waiting in the shadows to kill us at first opportunity. I placed my ear against the steel silo access door. I could hear them shuffling and moaning and beating the walls on the other side. John's Deception. May 19th, 1932 hours. On the night of the 17th, they made their assault. We were watching on thermal cameras and also on the unhindered front main camera when it happened. They brought crews of men to the launch bay pit where many undead had already fallen in. John's thermal cam had whiteout after a few minutes in the vicinity of the silo launch bay. After 10 minutes went by, I used my gloved hand to feel the lower silo access door. The door was very thick and sturdy, but the heat from the fire on the other side was immense. They were burning out the undead in the pit. They wanted down below and on the other side of the door I was standing at. We had to formulate a plan. John told me that he saw on thermal, just before the whiteout occurred, 4 men carrying a large box toward the broken area of the chain-link fence. It was probably some sort of cutting tool. Over the previous 24 hours, night of the 16th to the 17th, I had observed them continuing to use the herding tactic to keep the undead manageable. They had also brought a large 18-wheeled gasoline tanker with their convoy. We saw this on the satellite image before it became cloudy. I now estimated that their numbers to be 50 men and nearly 20 vehicles. We monitored the citizens' band radio for any intelligence. We could definitely hear them communicating. The code they were using sounded very familiar, much like the brevity code we were hearing on the radio a couple of weeks ago. It might as well have been Chinese. It didn't matter at this point. Judging by the thermal whiteout, the fire was still raging. I had to think of a way to get topside without detection and then somehow disorient them to the point of surrender. It was going to take all of us to pull this off. Here was the plan. I instructed Jan to make a radio call to the marauders at a certain time, The call was to inform them that this was an official government base and that there are more than 100 soldiers based here, all well armed. If they did not pull out, the soldiers would be authorized to use deadly force. She was instructed to make the call on the Marauder's frequency exactly 45 minutes after we left the compound. John and I remembered back to when we first came to Hotel 23. We slept in a small, enclosed chain-link fence area with a large manhole lid on the inside. In our days since the discovery of this place, John, Will, and I found out that it was, in fact, an escape scuttle designed as a redundancy exit if the others were knocked out. It was quite a ways from the silo doors and main entrance, and chances are it went unnoticed. The girls armed themselves with the carbines and the shotguns. I instructed them on the proper use of the shotgun in a steel living area. If they aimed the shotgun down at the floor at approximately 45 degrees, the 12-gauge pellets would ricochet and destroy anything in front of them in the steel passage. I was taught this tactic in anti-terrorism training designed to repel terrorist boarders from U.S. naval vessels. They didn't even have to see their target when using this tactic. I grabbed the M16 with the M203 launcher, all the ammo I would need, a blanket, and my NVGs. John and William took M16s and two M9 pistols and the binoculars. We headed for the emergency exit, approximately a third of a mile down a dark access tunnel. Some of the bulbs were burned out down here, and I constantly had to switch to night vision to lead John and Will to the hatch. John's hand stayed on my shoulder as I led them through the darkness. I could smell the fear in the air. We were all afraid. No one wanted to kill another human being, but this was our survival at stake. We could take no chances with those that wished us harm. We were at the hatch. Jan would be starting her watch countdown now. I checked the time. It was 21:55 hours. At 22:40, she would be making her radio call. We couldn't risk using the hydraulic motor to open the heavy hatch. Everything in this place had a backup, it seemed. We cranked the hatch open exactly 2 feet with 62 revolutions of the manual crank handle. There was no moon, and it was cloudy out that night. I could see the distant glow of the silo fire just over the hill near from the fence we were in. Together, we climbed over the razor wire fence, using the blanket I had brought from the complex. We were on the other side. There was no undead movement to either side of us at this side of the fence. We low-crawled up the embankment to level our vantage point with the bandits. There they were. Using the binoculars, I started a head count on them. I counted 45 in all. Many of the vehicles they were driving looked rather expensive. Many had Land Rovers and full-sized Hummers. They were all gathered around the fence near the vehicles, and the large fuel truck used to resupply them with dead dinosaurs. At this point, I was at a loss. We were grossly outnumbered and would easily lose in a firefight. All we could do was wait for Jan's radio message and hope they would pull out. It was 22:15. I could hear them talking faintly. I switched back on my NVGs to check the darker areas outside the burn of the silo fire. Funny. I could see the bags illuminated by the infrared beam of the camera inside them. The bags on the cameras looked like a green version of those old propane camp lights that use the cloth back and propane to generate light. It was 22:35. Minutes seemed like hours. In 5 minutes, we would know what we were up against. The marauders were dressed in a mixture of blue jeans and camouflage pants. Many of them looked fat and out of shape, their guts hanging over their pant line. It didn't matter. You don't have to be skinny to pull a trigger and hit your target. Go time. 22:40. I checked my watch and nodded to John and Will to remain very quiet. Nothing. No sign that they heard Jan's call. Then it came. I heard the group make the shh, all in unison, signaling their fellow bandits to be quiet. Then, loud laughter from the group, and one person shouting, "Fuck you, bitch! You have it! We want it!" Then came loud laughter, cursing, and weapons fire into the night sky. I had to grab William's arm to keep him from standing up in anger. The flames were disappearing, and I could no longer see the tops of them as they sunk below the lip of the silo doors. Time was running out. Using the binoculars, I could see some sort of welding cutting device being lugged inside the fence. These men wanted us dead. It was a matter of survival of the fittest. I made the decision. Rather than wait for them to overpower us inside the complex, I decided to hit them while they were all close together. It is a decision that will haunt me forever. I told John and Will to get down as I loaded the M16-mounted grenade launcher. I knew how far I was from the tanker. I adjusted the sights for my 100-meter target. I sat there, meditating for a moment, pondering on my decision. No more time to think. No more time to hesitate. I pulled the trigger. The grenade whistled through the air toward the fuel tanker. It landed about 2 or 3 meters from the middle of the trailer and detonated, sending hundreds of steel shards into the metal skin, holding the thousands of gallons of gasoline. Then came a huge explosion. I don't remember what happened after that. My next memory was of John and William taking turns giving me CPR at the base of the razor wire fence. I later found out that the concussion of the blast knocked me off my feet and threw me backwards 10 meters into the bottom section of the fence. They noted that I was lucky to hit a center section of the fence and not the post or the razor wire. I have been in bed since that day, recovering from burns and a probable concussion, according to Jan. John and William carried me back to the command center and made the radio call out to the rest of the marauders. We assume that some were out on herding duty. John broadcasted the following message on all available frequencies.
For the rogue group that has recently carried out hostilities against the government launch facility, be advised that 4 Apache helicopters were dispatched to this area to neutralize all hostile forces in the vicinity. Any further hostilities will result in maximum retaliation to your faction.
John repeated this message for half an hour. As of right now, we have received no response to the warning. I only hope John's deception worked. We may have won the battle for Hotel 23, but if a similar force decided to attack right now, we would fall. Either way you look at it, after killing almost 50 living men, I have some serious issues to deal with. In a way, I was happy to be knocked out to the point of near death, if only because I could not hear their last screams.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Day by Day Armageddon, written by J.L. Bourne, narrated by Jay Snyder. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Directed and engineered by Pete Rowan. Production coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2007 by J.L. Bourne. Production copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.